I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. I think I have never been so repulsed at the prospect of a radio conversation as I am right now, and I can reassure you, you should be too. I probably should also tell you, you're going to be very glad, very grateful that this is not TV. It's just the audio. And I'm saying all of this because we are going to the Disgusting Food Museum in Malmö, Sweden, which is really a thing, this museum. It exists, and it probably has a rationale, a raison d'être, which maybe we could get on board with, even if we are disinclined to ever set foot inside the place. Why would anybody establish and operate a disgusting food museum? I initially thought, well, there's one reason. We humans have this impulse to investigate things that are a bit sensational. We kind of like that. We're drawn to them. And then this morning I saw a video of things that will never cross my lips, because if they did cross my lips, they would immediately be projected right back out over my lips. I could not keep these things down. Don't even think I could get them within a foot of my mouth, for the most part. And again, I'm sparing you the video. Well, our guest right now is Andreas Arends, who is co-founder and director of the museum. He joins with us now grand technology that keeps me far from this disgusting food. Andreas, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much, Marcus.
You know, am I supposed to make light of this at all? Is this supposed to be, is there gravitas around this? Is this serious stuff?
Well, I mean, everyone have their own reaction to it. And I think it's very much about the mindset that we all have. The reason for the museum is twofold. First of all, to get people to realize that what we find disgusting and delicious, it's all up to where we grow up, what we are accustomed to. There's no such thing that is universally disgusting, more or less. We all have our own disgusting foods. And secondly, we want people to think about the new protein sources, such as insects, lab-grown meat, algae, and so on. Things that might appear disgusting at first, but if you get used to it, it's actually fine.
So if I walk into the museum, will I see placards and signage right off the bat giving me this very noble aim of the museum, or would I immediately be drawn into a display of something that's supposed to turn my stomach?
Well, the very first thing you get is actually your ticket, which is in the form of a vomit bag. Right after that, you get the sign in that is telling you a little bit more about the background of the museum, yes.
So you're very realistic about what might happen.
Oh, yes, it does happen from time to time. We've had 101 vomits in a little bit over 2 years.
101? Somebody's counting this.
Oh, yes, we have a vomit counter right next to the tasting bar.
Okay. Is there just one tasting bar?
Yes, one, yes. But we have about 15 different things that you can try there.
So are you in the kitchen making these things every day to get them all fresh and ready to serve?
Well, most of them are quite small portions, mostly refrigerated things, stinky cheeses, fermented fish, insects, and so on. So there's not much preparation and cooking involved. So it's not too hard to make sure that it's nice and ready to go every day.
Okay, start me out with this concept. Do you ramp up from the least disgusting to the most disgusting as you present foods? I'm just thinking that one ought to have an easy point of entree.
No, we have it arranged by location. So we have each part of the world grouped together. We have actually spaced out the crown jewels, so to speak, throughout the visit, so that you don't get all the highlights in one area. It's spaced out relatively well.
Well, the reason I ask the question is because I want to go into this. I want to ease my way into this experience if we're going to do it, even on the radio. I just want to be very cautious here. If you knew that I, Marcus Smith, I have a stomach that can really not abide foul smells, would you try to gradually acclimatize me to what I might experience? Would you give me something easy first?
Well, I mean, we could start off relatively easy with some insects, something like that. And that's actually the way we do it in the tasting bar, not in the museum itself. There we spread it out a bit, and it's not really in gradual. But in the tasting bar, we start off with something really easy, such as some crickets, and then we ramp up from there. And the thing that most people vomit from is actually in the very end of the tasting bar.
Yeah, now here on this show, we have had crickets to taste before, and
Yeah, they're fine.
they're not really repulsive. It's mind
No.
over matter. There's nothing for my palate that's going to say that that is either too bitter or too foul smelling, as though it were rotten flesh. It's palatable. Would you talk to me just a little bit about balut? And I'm very interested in balut because I had a brother who lived in the Philippines and he came back and told me stories about it. What is balut?
Yeah, I actually lived in the Philippines myself for almost 3 years. And it's the only thing that made me vomit so far in the museum. It is the partially developed fetus of a small bird, a duck. So you take an egg that is fertilized, you let it to mature anywhere from, say, 7 days for a Pinoy in the Philippines, up to, say, 25 or so days in Vietnam, a hot Việt Nam. So the longer you wait, the bigger the bird is and the harder it is mentally.
Yeah, is it boiled? Is it how is
Oh
it
yeah,
consumed?
you boil it for quite long. You boil it for about 45 minutes, and then you eat it. Usually it's eaten in the dark, not by everyone, but quite often it's eaten in the dark just to make sure you don't see it.
Now, there are street vendors, I understand, who make this available too.
Oh yes. When I lived there was a street vendor walking by every single day, two, three times a day, yelling balut. It's everywhere.
People like it.
Oh yes, they absolutely love it. Yeah.
And you, from your experience, you could not put it down.
No, but that was all mental. It wasn't about the taste. I've had it since, and the duck itself kind of tastes like a chicken soup. The rest of the egg tastes quite similar to scrambled eggs. So the taste is fine. It's just a mental aspect of it. I got the little bird, about the 1-inch little bird that on my spoon. I put it in my mouth, bit into it, and it kind of exploded in my mouth with blood and guts. That's what made me vomit, not the taste.
Yeah. Now, this gets to a very interesting consideration, which is that many of us are accustomed to eating certain parts of certain animals, but discarding
Right.
other parts. And if you're eating balut, are you setting aside the beak and the claws?
It depends a little bit on how far the little chiclet has gone. Usually you eat the whole thing. The bones and the beak, it starts to harden later in the process. So anywhere under 20 days, you can still quite easily eat all of it.
Okay. You come from where, and you say this is our disgust is culturally specific to our
Oh,
upbringing.
yeah.
And so tell me about your background and the kinds of things that maybe you have no problem with because you grew up with them, but would be hard for me.
Well, I think the best example would probably be salty licorice. I absolutely love salty licorice, but there's only six countries in the world that like it. The rest of the world think it's absolutely terrible. And very many Swedish people are very surprised that not everyone likes it. It's super salty. It's ammonium chloride rather than sodium chloride. But it's very, very salty. It's very corrosive on your tongue when you eat it. And I love that feeling. I look for that feeling.
Does it correspond in any way to the black licorice that I'd be familiar with?
Well, I mean, the licorice part is probably relatively similar, but it's incredibly salty. It's got salt covering all of it, basically. But the American black licorice is a very, very weak cousin, I would say, to salty licorice, and much sweeter.
Now, do you have visitors to the museum who arrive with their eyes wide open, knowing what they're getting into, and for them, this is just a matter of fun. They're going exploring and they're doing it without any trepidation whatsoever.
Yeah, I'd say that's quite common. A lot of people just want to explore the world of food. Some people want to have fun and laugh at it. We don't encourage people to laugh at the food of other cultures, quite the opposite, actually. We want people to understand that we are all equally disgusting. We're just blind to the disgust from our own culture. So whenever we find people, when we get visitors that take it a bit too lightly, we talk to them about it and say, like, look, we're all different, and that's okay. So it doesn't happen that often that we get people really taking it too lightly.
Is it difficult for you to stand up on moral grounds for some types of food? And I'm not just talking about that you're going to have people come who are maybe vegans, for instance, and but I'm talking about, you know, being somewhere in Korea and eating live octopus.
Yeah, sanaki. We definitely have it in the museum in the form of a video. And a lot of the things, they are... The reason that they are disgusting is that they are morally disgusting. It's the live octopus. You have ikusukuri from Japan, which is live fish. Foie gras, where ducks are force-fed. There are very, very many examples of that. And that is basically the only two types of food that I don't want to try myself. I try pretty much everything, but whenever something is too morally reprehensible, I don't want to try it. And when something is potentially deadly or dangerous, I don't want to try it. Everything else I try. When it comes to morally disgusting, I think the worst thing is probably the monkey brain table that we have from China. We take a living monkey, put it in a table. It's got a hole in it. So you put it in kind of a cage, and then you open up the cranium, lift it up, and eat the brain while the monkey is still alive. That's probably the height of the morally reprehensible.
Now, I had heard about this before, and I just thought that was bogus. I didn't think that was a real thing. That's a real thing.
It is. It can be found in old literature. We've found several visitors in the museum that either tried it themselves. They had relatives who worked in a monkey brain restaurant. We've had, well, that's anecdotal evidence, but we have a lot of it. So it's not something that's been very researched outside of our museum, I guess. But we have seen quite a few mentions of it in old books, and it's illegal in China. It's not specifically illegal in any other country because it hasn't happened in the other country.
Now you have touched upon something that is really fascinating to me, which is that the idea that our disgust from a culinary perspective, the idea that the cuisine could be disgusting to our sense of taste, our sense of smell, or even the way we to see it, that this disgust somehow correlates to a moral stance, and not just in terms of whether we're being cruel to an animal, but do we conflate moral disgust with gustatory disgust?
Yeah, I mean, it is interlinked. Something can be disgusting in many different ways. And of course, disgust exists way outside food. You can be disgusted by blood, by bodily fluids in general. But when it comes to food, it's usually when it comes to an animal suffering and the food being produced from animal suffering. And there we kind of come back to veganism again, as you touched on before. So a lot of vegans are, of course, vegans because of the moral implications. And there we see some vegans take an exception when it comes to insects because they don't have the same kind of developed nervous systems. And another interesting thing in the future is lab-grown meat. The lab-grown meat you can buy today is from vegetarian protein. But when you look in the future, we have animal protein-based lab-grown meat. It's still under development. It's still illegal. But then I think we enter something really interesting. If you are a vegetarian because of moral reasons, are you going to be able to eat lab-grown meat that uses animal protein when it's from an animal that's still alive? And I'm not sure every vegetarian, every vegan is going to come to the same conclusion when it comes to that.
I'd like to spend a little bit of time with you walking through some different categories of repulsive types of foods. You've got rotten foods, fermented foods, aged foods. Are there similarities across these categories from culture to culture to culture?
There are definitely similarities. So when you look at something like fermented foods, fermented fish, for example, in Sweden, we have surströmming, fermented herring. That is, by the way, the thing that most people have vomited from, about half of all vomits. And then you have kusaya, you have hongo from South Korea, also a fermented fish. There are plenty of different types of fermented fish, and they're more similar than different when you look at different locations. So fermented fish from Sweden or from Japan is quite similar in the sensation when it comes to the smell and some parts of the taste and so on. So yeah, definitely, there are things that connect us. And we are also more easily disgusted by foods that come from further away from us. So when it comes to, if we go back to the moral disgust, for example, someone who grew up in Europe might not be that repulsed by foie gras because it's something that we grew up having in our kind of in our cultural sphere, since it comes from France. Whereas when it comes to the monkey brain table or the live octopus that we talked about, it's further away from us geographically and culturally. So most people are more disgusted by that, which is quite interesting, even though there are some similarities in how we treat animals and how that affects the food itself.
Well, I have heard before that disgust is something that developed, evolutionarily speaking, as a protective kind of thing. That if you're disgusted by the stench of rotten food, that might protect you from pathogens. And so you're going to stay away from it. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Disgust is there to protect us from rotten food, from poisonous food. And that's one of the reasons why we have to learn to like bitter things. Bitter is associated with poison in nature. Most natural poisons are quite bitter. So something like coffee or beer that's quite bitter is something that most people don't, they're not born liking bitter tastes. You have to get used to it. It's kind of a part of becoming an adult to accustomizing yourself to bitter foods and drinks. Not sure why we have to do that, but most people do, right? But it's something that our body tells us, don't ingest this. This could be dangerous. This could be a poison.
I want to talk about a certain kind of cheese that I've heard of at your museum, maggot-infested cheese. With living maggots in it.
Yeah, the Casamalsu from Sardinia, Italy. You take a pecorino, you open up the top of it, you get cheese flies that come and lay eggs in it, up to 800 eggs. They hatch and the maggots, they eat the cheese, they poop out the cheese. And you eat it with the maggots still alive. They can jump up to 15 centimeters, so you have to cover your eyes when you eat it because it can jump up and bite into your eyeball, so you can get a retinal detachment. When you eat it, you have to make sure that you chew it enough to kill them. Otherwise, they can, worst case, survive in your stomach and bore through your intestines.
Yeah, this is ill-advised.
Yeah, there's a reason why it's illegal to buy and sell all over Europe. I've tried it. I've gotten it as a gift. I didn't buy it. And it was actually surprisingly tasty. It was kind of like a very spicy pecorino.
As you said, you chewed it quite well.
Oh, I did. I did. And I made sure I only had one maggot in the piece that I tried.
Well, this is the kind of thing that I think philosophically I am on board with, but viscerally I am not. The idea that you would want to expand the way we think about our alimentation, the way we are nourished and where the sources of those food. Does your museum get into these issues of let's look at the future and think about the sustainable food security?
Very much so. It's one of the biggest reasons that we exist, to make sure that people ease into the future protein sources, get used to it. So for most visitors, it's the first time that they try insects in a safe environment without people, saying that, oh, this is so disgusting, just gently getting them to try it. So we see it as a very good way to get people to have their first experience with insects, making sure that they realize that it's not really bad. It's a tastes very neutral. It has almost no taste. You can use it in to make bread, to make pasta. You can use it in casseroles. You can use it for many different things. So yes, that is a very, very big reason for our existence, to make sure that people get gently eased into that, because it takes time. It takes time for our collective cuisine to change, to incorporate new things. It takes many, many years. And different people, different organizations have to help in that transition. And we just try to take our part of it.
Andreas Arendt, you strike me as a brave soul.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure to visit with you. Andreas Arendt has been with us. He is the co-founder and director of the Disgusting Food Museum in Malmö, Sweden.
Great to have you along for Constant Wonder. I'm Tenere Taylor. You don't have to go to Sweden or the Philippines or Sardinia to try food that will stretch your boundaries. When Constant Wonder returns after a short break, we'll visit with an expert on bug eating and try some grasshoppers on the air. Constant Wonder will be right back. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenere Taylor. We're having fun talking about disgusting food this hour. And if you recall, Marcus's guest in Sweden said that one of the purposes of the Disgusting Food Museum is to acclimate people to eating bugs for protein. Well, we at Constant Wonder have been there and done that. A while back, an adventurous assistant producer named Louis Appel joined Constant Wonder producer Eric Schultzka with a plate of chili lime grasshoppers that Louis had caught up in the canyon here. They were speaking with a culinary bug expert. Here's a slice of that conversation.
On with us today, we have Daniela Martin, who has eaten insects all around the world, and she can tell us why we should eat them, how we should eat them, and even what they should taste like. She is the author of Edible, An Adventure into the World of Eating Insects and the Last Great Hope to Save the Planet. Daniela Martin, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I am going to tell you, first of all, that in front of me now, and in a few minutes, after we talk about your book, I have in front of me a little dish full of chili lime grasshoppers that one of our producers went up on a mountainside this weekend and caught and baked for us.
That's terrific. I'm so excited for you.
So I should introduce the producer in question. Louis Appel is here, and he is a fanatic about a lot of things, but he was thrilled to get a copy of your book. And as I said in a dad joke a moment ago off the air, he was waiting for it to arrive with bated breath. So Louis, you want to just say hi briefly before we...
Yeah, talk? Hello.
Louis is an enthusiast for a lot of things, and this is certainly one of them. Okay, so let's talk about eating insects. 80% of the world eats insects in some form or other. Can you just give us a shape for that? Like, what are we talking about here?
Sure. So it's 80% of the world's cultures, not 80% of the world's population.
Oh, okay. All right.
We're still working on that second part.
Well, how many? Okay, setting aside
a couple years, we'll get there.
Okay, setting aside 80% of the world's cultures, how many people would you say? I mean, we've got so many billion on the earth. Is this something that the largest shares of our population are doing on a regular basis? China, India, Africa?
It depends. The numbers keep sort of varying, and of course they're growing rapidly currently. So I think the number was around 2 billion. Okay. Something like that.
Okay. Well, that's a sizable chunk of the world's population is eating insects.
It is. Or at least have that somewhere in their cultural history.
Ah, okay. Now we're equivocating a little more, but that's fine. So tell us about your culinary experience with bugs. You've been around the world. I've read some of your experiences. Tell us what your favorite bug dish was.
My favorite... Oh man, there's so many to choose from. That's kind of like saying, well, what's your favorite meat-based dish? You know, do you like steak? Do you like fried chicken? Do you like salmon? Personally, I like all of them. I would be hard-pressed to say which was my favorite, but
okay.
I will mention some of my favorites.
Go ahead.
By the way, the very first bug I consciously ate was also chili lime grasshoppers.
Oh!
They are...
Okay.
Mm-hmm. They are known as chapulines in Mexico, and I actually had them in Oaxaca when I was studying pre-Columbian food and medicine in Mexico as a college student, which is how I got started on this whole thing. And I had bought a little bag full of them, and they were bright red, which I now know is because they have astaxanthin in their exoskeletons, which is the same thing that turns lobsters red when you boil them.
Whoa.
Yeah. now, you'll have to forgive me. I tend to go off on a lot of different
I'm going to have to rein you in.
And tangents.
But
yes, there are so many different... segments.
So Daniela, I'm capable of tangents myself, but why don't you, first of all,
I'll try to focus.
About the ant eggs in Thailand.
Oh, man. So, and interestingly, ant eggs are not only popular in places like Thailand and other Asian countries, they're also popular in certain Latin American countries. So that's kind of an interesting connection there. I actually don't know what the Thai word for them is, but in Spanish, in Mexico, they're called escamoles. And they're sort of a cross between a scrambled egg, like a very buttery scrambled eggs, with sort of the mouthfeel of large caviar, like ikura, that you would get at a Japanese restaurant. They kind of pop in your mouth a little bit, and then they're very creamy and very fresh in a way.
What do you mean by fresh?
They're quite incomparable.
Well, how are they cooked, first of all? I assume they're not eaten raw.
I believe they actually are sort of lightly fried, probably in a little bit of butter and salt, generally. But they don't require a lot of cooking. There's not that much that's going to get into an ant egg that could be harmful to humans. Pathogens, for instance, that would harm an insect are not likely to translate to human biology. So I actually believe there are some people that probably eat them raw, just like people eat fish eggs raw.
All right. Let's talk about the safety question then, because we arrived there indirectly. Let's just go ahead and take it on. There are people in this studio who think that this is really weird. I looked up the grasshopper issue on a backpacking survival guide, and they said if you're going to cook them in the wild, you're going to eat them in the wild, you should remove the entrails, which is kind of like what you do when you devein a shrimp, right?
Mm-hmm. A little bit. Some countries, they just squish them.
Okay. But Louis here has prepared them intact. Is that how the Mexicans do it?
That's how I've always eaten them.
You've always eaten them intact.
I've done what Louis has done. I've gone out into a field, collected them in a bug net, brought them home, and, you know, fried them right up in a frying pan. I've done that.
All right.
And they were terrific.
All right. So now let's talk about food safety, because I'm just going to tell you what's in my mind as we go into the food safety question. And that is the rat lungworm situation in Hawaii, where these crazy tourists keep eating raw slugs and then getting this wild parasite. So I'm thinking, OK, that's what I think of when I think of eating bugs. So tell me why this should not worry me.
Well, my understanding is that they're eating lettuce and whatnot that has not been properly washed.
Oh.
Not just eating slugs.
No, actually,
at
least in one
interesting trend.
In one case, it was a dare, and they actually did eat the slug on purpose. But okay,
that's just ridiculous.
Okay, so why is that ridiculous?
Should be eating slugs. Don't eat raw slugs. Raw slugs have they always have this potential for encephalitis. Don't do it.
Okay, can you eat cooked slugs?
In general, most of the bugs that you can find are going to be edible and more cooked.
Okay, we lost like you for a moment. Danielle, we lost you for a brief moment. Why don't you come back and finish your thought? Most of the bugs that you find are going to be edible
and safe. They won't all taste great.
Okay.
A lot of them are going to be bitter based on what they themselves consume.
Right.
But for instance, I'm here in Minnesota, where we're smack in the middle of a Minnesota summer. If I go into my backyard, the vast majority of the insects I would be able to catch would be edible. I could catch grasshoppers. I could catch dragonflies. I could catch bees and wasps. Those would be the majority of the things I would probably get in my net. The one thing you want to look out for is color. If an insect is brightly colored, you want to stay away from it. There is an old sort of adage. It goes, let's see. Been so long. Red, green, red, or red. Oh man!
Brightly colored.
Brightly colored means go away. Brightly colored is an advertisement to the rest of nature.
Oh,
which means don't eat me.
That's actually an advertisement. That's an adage that applies to eating as food, not just to like they might sting you or have poison on their skin.
Yes, exactly. It's basically lets birds know, for instance, that they would not make a good meal. Ladybugs, for instance, are a perfect example of that. If I go out into my garden right now, I probably would find ladybugs. However, the beautifully colored Japanese beetles, which I guess you could say are sort of a shiny iridescent green, those actually are edible. I have a friend in Missouri who, you know, collects them by the jarful and roasts them up, and they're terrific.
Okay, so what is it? Is there a toxin? What is it that defines the ones that are bad for you?
That's a great question. And now we have to remember that in the majority of species on the planet Earth are insects. And within that category, the majority of them are beetles. So there are so many that it's hard to pinpoint. Some of them just taste bitter. Some of them might have... It's rare that they would have... I mean, I guess it's possible they could have a venom. It really depends. I believe they just taste really bitter. They'll leave a bad taste in your mouth. That's the majority of them.
Okay,
that's
so
the majority of the biodefense there that's being used.
It sounds to me that if you have any skittishness at all, you would definitely want a list of approved bugs before you start doing this.
Yes, and there are plenty of places to find them. I personally have one on my own website, which is girlmeetsbug.com. I have a list of edible insects. There are actually books now that you can buy, sort of field guides to edible insects, which have been more or less self-published on Amazon. I actually, in my book, Edible, there's also a list, which, by the way, my book is on sale for 99 cents right now on Amazon Kindle. So if anybody wanted to find out with a very low initial investment, it'd be right there. But it just as a general rule, if an insect is camouflaged to blend in with its environment, generally it doesn't have that secondary biodefense of being a somewhat dangerous or toxic to eat. So grasshoppers, crickets, ants, animals like this are generally good to go.
Now, I understand that a lot of ants are bitter. Is that right?
Well, some say bitter, others say spicy. For instance, you probably would want to stay away from red ants, as I understand they're a little bit too spicy. Ants contain something called formic acid, which does have to some... A spicy bite and to others, I guess, tastes bitter. But ants are a very popular food in several Latin American countries as well as in Thailand. We were just talking about ant eggs. In Colombia, for instance, they eat something called big butt ants, which are these, they call them hormigas culonas. Culonas means big butt. And they have these large abdomens. And when their breeding season comes, they are a present on a lot of menus. They sort of roast them up like popcorn. I wouldn't say... across the board that ants are bitter tasting.
Okay. I remember watching a documentary, now that you mentioned a documentary not long ago, that showed a soup in South America somewhere that is made of ants, and they said it tastes like lemongrass.
Ah, so this may be another type of ant. I think they sometimes are even called lemon ants, and they're found often in the jungle, and they are said to taste very citrusy.
Yeah, this would have been an Amazon jungle kind of thing. That's the setting that I have in mind for it.
Mm-hmm. And actually, this leads me to another tangent. Mm-hmm. I just recently read an article about a research study that was done on the antioxidant content of insects. And interestingly, there are several insect species that provide more antioxidants, at least in vitro in the lab, than the things we would think of as being very high. So I think they found that giant cicadas had a higher level of antioxidants than olive oil. And certain other ones, like I believe it was crickets, silkworms, and ants, had higher antioxidant levels than orange juice.
Do they have cholesterol?
So I think they're a lot, again, we're talking about a very broad category of animals
right.
here. So something like a silkworm, which is technically a pupa, it's the larva of the insect, it's the veal. that probably might have some cholesterol in it. Mm-hmm. Something more like a cricket, probably less so. They tend to be a little higher in protein and lower in fat than more of the larval bugs like mealworms and waxworms and silkworms.
All right. I have in my hand, I've been delaying the moment, but I have in my hand the grasshopper. And let me tell you what I'm looking at. I'm looking at one of the antenna is still on. I'm looking at its head. The legs have mostly come off just in transit. And the abdomen is looking suspiciously sizable. So I'm still nervous about the abdomen.
What
Go ahead.
Color? What color are they?
You know, it didn't turn red. That's what's funny.
It didn't do the red.
No, okay. It actually still looks like, I'd say, the natural color. Okay, so I got Louie here. Louie, tell us what All you right. did, where you got these and what you did with them.
Well, so me and my younger brother actually went up in the canyon and we ran around with a butterfly net. And it was funny. We had lots of conversations with people who would ask us, what are you trying to catch? And we'd say grasshoppers, and they'd say, why? To eat. And the only person who didn't freak out was a Colombian woman who said, oh, yeah, we eat ants all the time.
How fantastic that you ran into somebody that had a reference.
Certainly. And as a matter of fact, they have gone redder. They were not that red when we started. And I love them. They're delicious. We also caught some dragonflies. Unfortunately, I ate those, and they were even better.
Did you eat the wings on the dragonfly?
I did.
What is it like?
I don't know. Just
like a potato chip?
No, there wasn't much taste to them. It's very, very thin, very little content to the... Yeah. It was just a little bit of texture.
Now, I understand from what Louis told me, Danielle, that I encourage people to go easy on the dragonflies because they're good for eating other bugs. Is that right?
Well, yeah, it's a trade-off. The more dragonflies you eat, the more mosquitoes you're going to have
exactly.
to deal with.
Exactly. So go easy on the dragonflies. Okay, grasshoppers, right. on the other hand. You know, we have an interesting reference point here on grasshoppers because in Utah, when the settlers first arrived, they had a grasshopper plague. And it's part of the whole legend of the state, trying to contain the grasshoppers. And what they didn't realize is they should have just made use of them.
Well, exactly, and they did. Some of them wound up trading with the local. Is it the Paiute?
The Utes, the northern Utes. I think I remember from your book. That's how you're, and that would be the natives here in Utah. Yes,
right. So they wound up trading with them, and one of the things that they wound up trading with something called pemmican. I believe I'm pronouncing that correct.
Yeah,
and
pemmican.
It's sort of the earliest version of an energy bar. And ground up, you know, dried grasshoppers were often an element along with berries and nuts and things. And specifically in the Utah region, of course, there were the Salt Lake Caves where archaeologists found stores, you know, hundreds of years old stores of grasshoppers where they had been collected off of the shores of Salt Lake, just sun-dried and salted straight from the waters and stored in these caves to be saved to be eaten during the winter.
All right.
So this is, you're really in the perfect place to be eating grasshoppers.
Okay, so
there's
I'm going to delay it a moment longer, and Louis is going to tell me what he did with them once they got them home.
So we threw them in the freezer for 2 nights, and then I just put them in the oven for about 40 minutes, which may have been a little bit too long, but they taste delicious. I think it's kind of like eating chips.
Better safe than sorry. You said it was 350 for 40 minutes. Where'd you come up with those numbers?
I didn't. This was an experiment.
Oh, great. Okay. All right. Well, I'm pretty confident that 350 at 40 minutes for something as small as a grasshopper is going to be safe. So
that's
all right.
Good and yeah.
Here goes. Oh, I don't know if I call it good. I call it a non-event. It's unremarkable.
Well, 350 at 400. You know, 350 at 40 minutes. Yeah, that's going to be
okay. So I just ate it, and I barely even tasted any chili lime. What I tasted was kind of toasty. Kind of like if you had toasted some kind of pine nut or something. It was and it actually has a nice after flavor. It's not it tastes like kind of like, I don't know, it's just toasty.
Yeah.
And I don't
feel nutty. Those are common flavor notes.
Yeah, exactly. Toasty and nutty. And I do not sense that I'm swallowing any parts that are going to cause problems. I think I chewed them up pretty thoroughly. And they came apart quickly because you cooked it so thoroughly. They kind of dustified in my mouth as soon as I crunched. Okay, well, I got that one out of the way. And I think I'm okay with hopping creatures. I think the slimy larva type things are going to be another matter altogether. Have you had mealworms, Louis?
No, I haven't, but I am in the process of ordering some.
He's ordering mealworms. Okay. Hi. Well, we'll keep an eye on Louis and make sure he's all right. We have been speaking with Daniela Martin, the author of Edible, An Adventure into the World of Eating Insects and the Last Great Hopes to Save the Planet. And her book is on sale right now at Amazon Kindle. You should check it out in some form if you want a free source of protein. Thank you for joining us, Daniela Martin.
Thank you so much for having me, and way to go trying your first book.
Thank you.
Well, if you've had your fill of disgusting and challenging food, we're moving on to another course. In just a minute, we'll head to Texas, a state that takes its barbecue so seriously that barbecue is actually a competitive high school sport. Constant Wonder will be right back. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. In Texas, as far as sports go, football reigns supreme. To join in the action, fans tailgate, grilling and chilling before the game begins. But barbecuing itself is a competitive sport in some parts of the Lone Star State, where students compete to create the best beans, desserts, brisket, chicken, and ribs. For barbecue instructors like Tommy Copeland, teaching his team life lessons is even more important than the meat. Marcus Smith spoke with him a while back. Here's a highlight from that conversation.
Ennis is located about 25 to 30 miles south of Dallas on I-45. We are a railroad town that started in about 1873, and it's 4A school. We have one high school in town, and we got started in cooking barbecue about 2 years ago when our arch rival, which is Waxahachie, which is the county seat, challenged us to a cooking contest. And so whatever Waxahachie wants to try to beat us at, we're always game to get after them. So we had four seniors that stepped up, and we formed a barbecue team, and that was the beginning of our barbecue experience.
Now, did it make sense to you that this would take off and be something quite popular, or did you have a hunch, or was it just kind of like a trial?
It just happened. Our boys love to cook. The ones that we had are now graduated, and several of them are talking about maybe starting a restaurant. They like it that much, but we did not know that there was already an organization started by a young cooking instructor at Burnett High School, and he had set together a regional contest. And when we had the contest in Waxahachie, some of his people were there and tasted our food and said, "We want y'all to come to the state competition. Y'all are good enough to be in our group." So from that start is when we found out that, hey, there's a whole group of high school barbecuers that are starting up around here. So it's been, from that point, we've been involved.
I'm just wondering how intense this competition is. You know, years ago, I was just stunned when somebody I knew who lived across the street from me, I saw him practically spitting nails, and he walked 20 times around the block here in town because his baseball team had lost. And I knew that he was fiercely loyal to this and that it really, really mattered. Does barbecue competition take on that kind of gravity?
Yes, it does. We're a Czech community, and our heritage is wet barbecue. There's two great divides, dry rub and wet. And so by tradition, we make more of a wet barbecue for all of our festivities. And there's a big debate, you know, dry rub versus wet, what's the better one? And so you get a lot of opinions, pretty strong opinions about which is the best barbecue and who makes it and how is it done. And so, yeah, you get some lively conversations among barbecue people.
Do you ever take on, you know how people will take on, you know, refs and umpires and officials at any kind of competitive sport? I'm just wondering if this is so subjective in the end that you can't, you know, take issue with the verdict, who wins?
No, I think when the dust is settled and the awards have been given out, everybody's ready to do the next competition. We have a way we think that ribs ought to be cooked, and when somebody says, well, no, this is the way it is, you know, we will disagree, but be friendly about it. But, yes, judges are subjective. You know, they've grown up eating barbecue like they like it, and so you're going to run into that sometimes that, you know, our barbecue may not be the one that – that reminds them of what they like.
So even the competitive barbecuing requires a kind of sportsmanship.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Well, I understand that there's something really, really big about your barbecue team, and it has to do with the grill. You built a grill, and I'm wondering why that mattered.
Right. We're a career technology division of our high school. So our boys and girls that come through the CATE experience have a welding teacher that's Brian Harlan, that is an excellent teacher, and part of what they do is build competitive grills and actually show them at some of our state shows, and they've done very well with them. So there's a great pride in building a grill that that really matches what you're trying to do. So yeah, there's some real engineering. And their welding is excellent. And so these guys are really good at that craft.
Well, yeah, if you build a grill and you take it to a competition, is it about the grill or is it about the end product, the meat? I'm just wondering will the judges say, that's a great grill because we tasted what you grilled on it? Or are they just going to look at the welds?
Yeah. So in a state fair competition we go in Dallas to do, they're going to look at the welds and look at the design. But when we go to a cooking competition, they're going to say, how well does that grill prepare meat for you? How's it working for you? So they're looking at both when we do it. But cooking competition, it's all about the meat.
Where are these competitions held? How frequently?
They set on regionals. They start in about January. About every month, there's going to be a regional competition somewhere in Texas with high schoolers. And it ends in May with a state competition at Burnet.
So that's not football season?
No. Football season ends at Christmas. So.
I'm so disheartened. I want you to take those grills to the parties before the games.
Oh, we practice. So, and we start in August with the football season, and we practice with our grills before the game. We have a home game. We'll cook.
Have you heard of this going on anywhere else but Texas? It sounds like such a Texas thing to me, but I understand over 100 schools at the state competition. And do you cross borders to, you know, go over to Oklahoma and take on those people? Or is it all in Texas?
Well, I just spoke this morning with a gentleman in North Carolina who is in charge of 37 high schools in their cooking division and their in the fine arts department, and I guess I'm saying he wants to start something in North Carolina, and he was interested and pleased to know what we'd already done here in Texas. So I think it's growing. He said there's a really big competition in Tennessee, but I'm not aware of what they have. But maybe someday we'll see a national competition of barbecuers from high school. That's something that might happen.
Now, when you cook something that's really, really good, and if it's going to be a champion, and you're going to be the champions, you're going to have some secrets in what you do. I'm wondering, do you keep your recipes secret? You already told us that you've got the wet rub, the Czech influence. And is it just always meat that you're doing, or is the menu a little bit more than beyond the meat?
Yes. So there's a barbecue sauce that we enter, a dessert, a red bean, pinto bean competition. And so chicken, ribs, and brisket are all – so there's six categories that we're dealing with. And there are some secrets. One thing I'll just say that we do is that technology has increased. We have wireless probes in our meat that gives us constant readings of what the internal temperature of the meat is, and that really helps us in determining when it's at its prime.
Can you break a tooth on one of those by mistake?
I know. No, they're we pull them out, make sure they're out before we serve. But they're really high tech. We can do about five things at one time, five different places on either one piece of meat or on several. So we can the kids can monitor. The sponsors like myself are not allowed in the cooking area. It is only the kids can be where the cooking is taking place. So everything is in there.
Yeah, Tommy Copeland, I'm going to paint a scenario for you, and I want you to tell me the truth on this, okay? You take your team to a competition. They enter in all these different categories, and I'm just imagining that if you came away with the trophy for the beans, that's going to be kind of hardly even a consolation prize if you don't get the trophy for the meat. Am I right?
Right. That's correct. It's all about the meat.
At the time of this interview, Tommy Copeland was a high school horticulture teacher at Ennis High School in Texas, where he also founded and coached the competitive barbecue team. We're going to finish off the hour with a shout out to an enormous fish that's rarely seen. Now, this fish is not really good for eating, but biologists get really excited when an oarfish washes up. Misty Peg Tran, a biology professor at California State University, got possession of one, and I asked her the question, where do you put a giant stinking fish while racing it to your lab?
My Nissan, you know.
Wait. In a car? You put a dead fish in your
right.
car? Oh, my gosh.
In a cooler, but in my car.
Well,
and so
it's got to be falling out of that cooler. I'm sorry. This would not be allowed at my house.
Yeah, my husband wasn't really pleased with the smell that was left over. It took a while.
Well, managing such a large specimen must require quite a process.
Not a one-day thing. It has to be planned out, and it has to be, going from the very macro level or the whole organism. And before you ever sort of slice and dice and look into it, you have to know exactly what you're going to do. So for me, it was, you know, while it was whole, I had to get a CAT scan of this thing so that I could preserve the entire body before I ever cut into it.
Monday, hear the story of a scrappy group of Japanese-American kids whose parents worked Hawaiian sugar plantations and who learned to swim in an irrigation ditch. But their swim club had dreams of Olympic glory. Derailed by World War II, they fought the Axis powers in Italy, and one of them returned to grab Olympic gold in swimming in 1948. An inspiring story of never giving up. Monday on Constant Wonder. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.